Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the program. Today's show is a special. Actually, we're trying to reconvene what we started last week, and we hit some technical glitches. Murphy was doing his best to prevent us holding the show, and actually, and Mr. Murphy seems to be at work today as well. We hear much on the television about the war on drugs, yet what do we really know about drug use in the U.S. today? To answer that question, we've assembled an interesting panel. As always, we encourage our listeners to call in with their questions and comments. Our switchboard number is area code 646-378-1120. Also, our chat room is open, and you're welcome to go in there and ask your questions. That's if you're too shy to actually face us folks. So, let's go to the panel. Do we have Mitch Stone with us? Mitch, are you with us? Nope, apparently not. Armando, are you with us?
I'm here.
Okay. Armando, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, I'm from the Orlando area. I have two books in print. I have a lot of friends, and I've lost a lot of friends to the drug world. I grew up myself in a bad neighborhood where drug was pretty much the theme everywhere, from drug houses to drug dealers on the corners to, I mean, you couldn't get out of it. I mean, walk down the street, they're offering it to you whether you like it or not. And that's when I came to write the books, pretty much to give the addict's point across, even though I've never been an addict. But,
yeah. Okay, we also have Carlton with us. Carlton, why don't you tell us a little bit about your story?
Well, I was addicted to crack cocaine for almost 9 years or more, and probably to marijuana for, oh, I would say 10 or 15 years before that. And I was really using drugs as a way of self-medication for my condition of bipolar disorder. And drugs helped me keep my high and suppressed, or I could say lifted my low. And drug addiction for me was a way around, as I say, was self-medication, basically. That's what I used it for.
The drug world is a pretty insidious one. You know, I watch CNN, and CNN seems to have become the Michael Jackson channel of late. You know, it's not just street drugs that are the issue. Prescription drugs are a major, major, major issue.
That certainly is true. You know, I've been doing a lot of reading on the internet about this, and I find that a lot of young people and a lot of others have fallen foul of this problem, especially with drugs like Zoloft and Xanax and things like that, where you have people in prison for murdering other people from coming down from that drug. I just read a case of a young man in Montana who was serving 35 years to life in prison for a murder of a person he knew, that when he came down off of withdrawing from Zoloft.
Huh. Man. Armando, I have a really strange question for you. What area code are you calling in from?
407.
Okay. We have a caller on the line from 360. Hello, caller.
Hi, this is Queenie. Hi, Simon, Carlton, Armando.
Hi. What's your question for us?
Well, I was kind of excited when I heard Carlton talk about his problems with mental illness and then self-medicating, because I had a son. I still have a son, I should say. And he was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder back in 1997, and after about a year of in and out of the hospital and risperidol, the whole bit, he made a choice to start self-medicating, and he got into meth. And I just, my question, I guess, is, do you think that a lot of people are, you know, is this a problem that spread throughout, you know, the United States with mental illness, people self-medicating?
I have a couple of theories about it. For about 6.5 years, I operated a computer learning center, and we based our operations out of a homeless shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And drugs were very rampant. And what I noticed was an incredibly high percentage of drug users had some mental disorder of some type. Carlton, you're bipolar.
Yes.
And I can't tell you how many bipolar sufferers I came across that were also drug users. I mean, the two just seem to go hand in hand.
That's right.
I think it's very common. I mean, I think it's very common amongst other schizophrenics. I think people who are have a schizoaffective disorder. I think it's very, very common amongst people with all forms of mental illness. Perhaps more common amongst bipolar, though I certainly don't know the statistics. But you know, it's just an easy way to self-medicate. You know, it lifts the highs. When if you want to get higher, when you're manic, you can keep the high up. And when you're depressed, it lifts the down. And so it's very easy to do. It's very easy to fall into the trap of it and to continue on that way for a long time. And for me, I didn't know I was bipolar for many, 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 many years. And it was a way that I was able to maintain myself and to maintain the feeling, the good feelings that I had, and to keep the bad feelings at bay by, first was smoking marijuana, and then marijuana didn't work anymore. And when I went out to find another drug, I found, wow, I found this drug called crack cocaine, and wow, did it work, except it had incredible side effects, you know.
Were you functioning, though, while you were taking, you know, while you were addicted to crack?
I was functioning. I was a functioning addict for most of my life, until the very end when I wasn't functioning anymore. I'd become very suicidal, and I'd become very unreliable at work. I would became explosive, you know, at the mere anything that went wrong, I became explosive and was throwing things across rooms and stomping out of work and ripping up paychecks and becoming very
dangerous,
inconsistent, you know. But I generally worked. I never ended up homeless, you know, as many had.
Many people have ended up homeless. I want to bring another caller onto the line. Area code 650. Hello, area code 650. Oh, I guess they don't want to talk to us. They just want to hang out. It's all... Yeah. Well, let's go back to the back to the conversation. Homelessness, drugs seem to go hand in hand. What I can't figure is how does even a working person that's pulling in a reasonable salary afford the drugs? I know I couldn't.
Yeah.
You just use up all your income on that. Yes? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was going to say a lot of the young addicts to crack cocaine and so forth. I mean, from what I've noticed and from people that I've known, they get a lot of this money. A lot of the resource comes from their parents, from them just saying, you know, I need it for this or that, or just to go hang out. You know, the parents, they're not thinking, you know, that it's going to go towards that. And then, in actuality, they're actually supporting their habit.
Hmm.
In the end, I wasn't working, and I borrowed about $50,000 or more from my wife, and I smoked it all up, you know, in a very short period of time.
$50,000?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I used that up in less than 6 months. And I told her at that time that I was using it to go off and work on a book or work on some creative endeavors that I was going to do. I was going to work on my art, and I didn't do any such thing. I just hung out in the studio I had and smoked crack cocaine every day until it was all gone.
Now, Colton, you have an interesting story about how you kicked the habit. I mean, we've all heard about the 12-step program and, you know, Cocaine Anonymous and all of these other organizations. Your story, though, is a little off the wall. I think would be the best way to describe it. What happened to you?
Well, none of those programs worked for me. As a matter of fact, the 12 steps, whenever I went to 12-step meetings, the only thing I ever wanted to do after I came back from one of those was use more. And it just did not work for me. I went and tried, went to the Betty Ford Clinic. I tried things like alternate kinds of programs, and none of them worked. What happened for me was that I finally got so bad that I was attempting suicide, and I was up on a bridge, was about ready to jump off, and I couldn't do it because I couldn't kill someone else in the process of killing myself. And my wife and my doctor got me into a mental hospital, and in there I finally got diagnosed as bipolar, and I got medication for this disease that I have, and the medication took away my entire desire to use drugs. Just like that, poof, it was gone.
Wow!
Wow!
That is a story you do not hear very often.
Not at all.
Not at all. Armando, you have lost a couple of good friends to drugs. Do you have any good stories for us? Any success stories?
No, I don't. I have family members that actually passed away from, you know, usage of drugs, heroin, cocaine. A friend of mine just recently actually died of an overdose, and from my knowledge, he was in a 12-step program, you know, months before that. So after coming out of that, he just went on to use even more and ended his life. So, no, I don't personally have any successful stories that's come out of friends and families and anything that I've known about drugs.
The question really is, what do we need to do to fix the problem? I mean, you know, we hear about all of this, you know, war on drugs stuff. You know, the government's cracking down on the news. We hear about oh, you know, busted a trucker bringing in, you know, Lord knows how many kilos of cocaine. But there's still an awful lot getting through. I mean, what can we do to stop it, to fix it?
Well, we're clearly not winning the war on drugs. You know, it,
no.
as much as we try to stop it at the borders, it's coming in other ways. As much as we stop illegal drugs, prescription drugs are rising in their use, you know, in the abuse of them. So to my mind, you know, we have to look at other ways of doing this. Illegalization is not working. You know, to my mind, we have to look at probably legalizing all drugs. I hate to say this, and there are certain problems with even doing that, but legalization and turning the problem around and treating it as a health problem rather than a criminal problem is probably the only way to go.
Armando, you said something to me last week, and I did some poking around. Mexico has just passed what I consider to be a pretty radical law. Have you been following up on it?
Actually, it's funny that, you know, like Colin, like you mentioned the border, because it's corrupt on both sides. So the U.S. has a huge demand for drugs, and Mexico has the corrupt police officials. And, you know, like the Mexican laws now are totally lenient towards drugs, allowing you to carry 5 grams of weed, 1 gram of cocaine, 21 milligrams of heroin, and it's catching on through the United States. So, as far as like what Colin was saying, to try to fix it through that way, I'm not too sure if that's going to work. But rehabilitating the addict and working with them could stop a lot of things, in my opinion.
Well, Colin, would you go along with what Mexico are doing?
No.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, decriminalizing is the only way. I mean, you know, obviously some drugs have a therapeutic use. Here in California, marijuana has shown to be useful in staunching cancer and treating cancer, you know, at least the pain and suffering of cancer. I don't know if it actually does anything to mitigate cancer. But we have the federal government trying to close all the cancer clinics, marijuana dispensing clinics down. So you have all these inconsistencies in the law, and you have all of our jails are filled up to the max with people on drug charges. We have more people in prison in America than anywhere else in the world, and most of these people are there on drug charges. And it's ludicrous. And we are way behind the rest of the world on our viewpoint about drugs. And basically, let's face it, America is a drug culture. You get inundated with advertisements for drugs on television. And some of these drugs, if you take them in excess or if they don't work with you, they kill you, you know, or they can make you kill other people, such as Zoloft and other things like this, which I spoke about before, you know. it's crazy.
Okay, someone's breaking up.
I hope it's not me.
I think legalizing it could actually, you know, bring a lot of side effects to that as well. You know, it could actually create more addicts or even expand the drugs. I mean, like you were saying, in California, there's over 500 dispensaries. I mean, there's a lot, and from what I hear, it's not that difficult to obtain a card that says that you can go ahead and go to these dispensaries and purchase marijuana legally. Personally, as far as like one, you know, grant, whatever amount of, you know, crack or whatever drug is allowed to be in Mexico, I personally wouldn't want my kids to look over and see someone using drugs and that's allowed to them. So it's a double-edged sword. It has its positives and its negatives.
Oh, it's very much a double-edged sword. Once again, I want to say to our listeners, please call in with your questions or comments. Our switchboard number is area code 646-378-1120. Now, going back to California for a second, as I understand it, it's decriminalized in one aspect and yet not in another. Sure, you can get a card to go pick up your marijuana at, you know, at your local Walgreens or whatever. However, you know, if you get stopped by the cops, they can still bust you.
Absolutely. Well, you can't get it at Walgreens, but they do it. Interesting thought. Someday you may be able to. The idea of you can go, or you used to be able to go to various clinics, marijuana dispensing clinics, although the federal government just busted a guy and put him in jail for 5 years for running a clinic that dispensed marijuana. So the state law allows you to do it, but the federal law does not. So you have a discrepancy between the state and the federal law, and that's where we have all this dichotomy that happens, you know. But, you know, marijuana is everywhere. What they discovered in Michael Jackson's apartment, marijuana, right? You know, along with Propofol or whatever it is that he was taking.
Propofol.
And Ativan and Valium and Versed.
Everything else that he was taking, you know.
Yeah.
So the poor man was killed by a combination of just about everything.
Well, I mean, okay, let's talk Michael Jackson for a minute here. You know, was he a victim, or did he actively seek these things out?
From what I heard on the news, he was begging his physician to give him these medicines after he told him that he wouldn't.
He actively was seeking these things out. I mean, I think that the man had obviously enough money to be able to buy whatever he wanted. But it's a sad case that he was able to be able to get whatever he wanted, and that he could find doctors who would prescribe this to them. He could find doctors who would prescribe this to him anywhere in the world, and they would give him this stuff. And this Propofol, or whatever it is called, I can't exactly remember, that's the name, can stop your heart. And people are injecting this stuff all the time, and I understand this is a legal drug, and this is something that can kill you. So we're faced with this drug culture all around us. And how can we prevent people from taking it? We can't. And it crack, heroin, and all these other things, there are people out there who are functioning addicts taking this stuff. We have to treat this as a health problem, not as a criminal problem. We have to get these thousands of people out of jail whose lives are being destroyed in jail, you know, for something, for, you know, a couple of joints or a lid of marijuana. You know, it's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous, the whole situation. But what we have is a whole structure that's been built up around criminalizing drugs, which is the prosecutorial system, the border system, you know, the whole legal network that's been built up around this to criminalize this. We have to bring that down and bring it to where it needs to be, in health rather than in legal, in the legal world. At least that's my opinion anyway.
Okay. So what you're saying is, you know, legalize everything, and let's put the effort into basically a stop smoking campaign.
Put it in, tax the hell out of these guys. let them produce cocaine in South America and tax the hell out of it. Make make crack cocaine cost $200 an ounce. You can buy it at Walgreens, you know. Just a pack of crack cocaine cigarettes costs, you know, $100. You know?
Okay, we have another caller on the line. Someone coming in from the 862 area code. Hello, 862.
Yes, hey, how's it going?
It's going very well.
Hey, this is actually a LifeLinks video relay call. I'm interpreter 318. I'm going to be doing sign language for the caller.
Okay.
We're using video technology.
All right. What's your caller's name, and what's their question or comment?
My name is AJ. I was just listening. Really, I tell you, I just logged on, so I haven't really been listening to the topic for so long. But you know, I'm gonna just curious to see what's going on and see what you guys are discussing, and maybe I can chime in. I don't know.
Sure. Okay. Well, hold on the line. If something grabs your attention, just jump in. The prescription drug issue, and you know, this is one that keeps hitting the press. We don't hear so much about prescription drugs and the man in the street, but we hear a lot about it when you start talking about famous people. I mean, we have Rush Limbaugh. We have Michael Jackson. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. How prevalent is it? Is this an issue for you know, regular people?
Well, I think it is. I think I mean, we know that doctors get hooked easily. People, at least here in Hollywood, in the entertainment industry, behind the scenes, people get hooked all the time on this stuff. And I think other people in high-pressure jobs get hooked easily. I mean, we live in a high-pressure world, and it is so easy to get hooked on drugs that keep the pain down, you get injured, you know.
Society.
You know, you want to keep that pain down, so you get hooked on one of these painkillers. Easy, so easy. But what do I know? I'm just an author of a little old book called Bipolar Bear about being, you know, being bipolar and being an addict. So I don't know. I'm speaking a lot here off the top of my head about opinions that I've grown to have over a lot of different years. So, you know. I'm
okay.
A very opinionated person.
I second that.
Colton, let's do an absolutely shameless advert for your book. Where can people buy it?
You can buy it on Amazon. Yeah.
And it's Bipolar Bear.
Yeah, spelled B-A-R-E.
Right, okay. While we're on the subject, Armando, let's do a shameless advert for your book.
you can get both of my books, What You're Turning Me Into and Cocaine Memoirs and Novels, at Amazon, any local bookstore.
And I can tell all of you listeners, these three books are well worth reading. They are eye opening. Carlton's is a biography. Armando's are two novels. However, I happen to know a little bit of the inside track, and there's a great deal of reality in Armando's novels. So pick them up, folks. You'll like them. Okay, back to the plot here. Prescription drugs, are the doctors to blame?
Not so much. I mean, they're pretty much prescribing you something to help you out. It's up to you to, you know, abuse the drug or...
All right.
Well, from what I know, people stockpile these things sometimes, you know, so that they have a whole lot of them. You know, I take a pretty serious cocktail of drugs to keep me balanced. And it really worries me that that what happens if I stop taking them or if I ever got to the point where I got really depressed and decided not to take them. What would happen to me? Would I go bananas, you know? And do something crazy. It worries me. Things like this worry me. And, you know, I just recently got kind of really down. This happens to me. I have a couple of times a year when I go way up and way down. And in the fall, I start to, this time of year, I go way down. And the doctor just increased the dose of one of the particular medicines I had by 3 times. And I get really up. And, I get so up, I have these wild dreams, and I went flying out of bed the other night, and cracked my knee on the floor with this huge bounce on the floor. Woke my wife up and everything. But and these kinds of things can happen. These are really powerful drugs that we take, you know. And people can really get hurt by them if they're not used to them, or. Things can happen to you. I mean, I really believe, you know, that coming off of them or getting onto them, you could be capable of severe kinds of things happening to you and hurting other people. I think it's possible. And these are legal.
Plus, a lot of people use, you know, these prescription pills to get off of their, to come down from their drugs, you know, like downers for uppers and so forth. And that alone can trigger... tons of things. Like if you're on, you know, on a cocaine binge, for example, and you don't know how to come down and you take a couple of Xanax, now you're pretty much speedballing while you're falling asleep.
Queenie, are you still on the line with us?
I'm here. I do have a question.
Sure. That was what I was going to ask you.
Well, is Carlton, are you artistic?
Am I... Artistic or autistic?
Yeah. artistic. I mean, you mentioned something about your studio.
Yeah, I am artistic. I'm a artist, a writer, and an architect. You know,
well,
somebody said
then,
to me I couldn't decide what I wanted to be. I still can't. You know.
Well, my question then, did the medicine that you're on for your bipolar, has it stifled your artistic abilities at all?
I get asked that question a lot, and when I first started on these drugs, yes, it did. It really leveled me out so much. I used to use this analogy. I felt like a round rock, you know, like
okay,
all the round
said,
rocks
yeah.
next to the river. I
a
felt
zombie,
like one of those round
yeah.
rocks. Took away all my interesting edges, and I had to work with my psychiatrist on finding the right combination of drugs and the right level of medication to bring back my creativity. So my creativity has come back. I don't have as high highs as I used to have, which were really high, and I don't have as really low lows as I have, but I have enough that I feel creative, enough that I could write my book, you know, so
that was
I was
one
able
of my
to do that.
Yeah, that was one of my son's complaints as to why, one of the reasons he went into street drugs, because he felt like a zombie when he was in the hospital getting on the medication.
Well,
the
recommendation that I make to somebody is you have to work with your psychiatrist to find the right combination of drugs that will work so that you don't lose that quality of your life. Because
yeah,
I know
he
that
gave up,
feeling.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to lose it. I didn't want to lose it. And I complained to my shrink, and we worked it out.
Actually, one of the things that I noticed in my time working with the homeless folks is that almost 100% of the people that suffered from bipolar had an artistic bent.
Exactly. And schizophrenia as well.
Oh, yes, most definitely. In fact, my wife and I took in a roommate. It's a long, complicated story. And he was bipolar. He was the nicest guy on the planet. But, boy, I mean, paranoid. Never seen anything like it in my life.
Yeah. Well, they're living a living hell, I'll tell you that.
Something like that. In fact, our friend always wanted to be helpful. And, he would say, I'll do the dishes. And it would take him, 2 hours. He'd clean one plate and then go sit down, listen to some music, get up, clean another plate. it was amusing, but just not regular life, shall we say.
Right.
Armando, you might feel this. I think that all people that tend toward drugs are looking for some kind of something different, something to make their lives more special. They're looking for, some way of feeling different, and our artisticness goes with that. All of the drug addicts I've ever met, and I've met a lot of them, have always had a quality to them that they've been looking for something different. They've got themselves to be different in a way.
I agree. My friend who just recently passed away from a drug overdose, I own a music company, so I have a music studio, and he used to come over all the time, and he was one of the best music engineers that I've ever known. He was very artistic in very different ways, so I definitely agree. He was always trying to correct everything in his life, and he just never got there.
All right, I'm going to throw out the silly question of the day, which I'm sure will get me beaten senseless. Does marijuana lead to stronger things?
My mom said so.
I would say no, but then that would depend. That depends on the individual. I've known addicts that have been heroin addicts that's never even smoked pot, don't like it.
Right. Actually, I've known, or I do know, a number of people, and marijuana's their thing, and they're functioning human beings.
I know those.
they work hard. They go home. They that their method of relaxation. Roll a joint.
and they won't advance to nothing more.
Right. And yet, right. It's made of the idea that, if you do marijuana, you're going to move on to stronger things.
Well, doesn't that depend on the individual?
Right. Yeah, definitely.
Once again, I would say, it depends on the individual. I have a good friend of mine who's smoked marijuana now for must be at least 40 years, and he's never gone on to anything else. He comes home and he does exactly what you say. He has a joint, he sits down and has a beer and a joint, and that's the way he relaxes. And, other people I know couldn't smoke a joint if you tried to give them one. They can't handle it. It doesn't feel good to them, the state of being high on a marijuana joint. For me, I use marijuana as a way, as I say, self-medicating. And after a while, my body became so used to it that it no longer did what it was supposed to do anymore for me.
Right.
And I had to move on. So it did lead. It was a gateway to something else, but that was a gateway after, a good 9 or 10 years of using it. And my body just got so, adapted to it that it didn't work anymore. It didn't get high.
Right. It's like taking aspirins for a headache. You start off with one, and before you know it, you're taking 4 or 5.
Yeah.
Dennis Excedrin.
Right. My wife's the expert on that one.
and Excedrin is like pretty much a lower tab without, you know, the hydrocodone or the.
Right. We have a caller coming in.
Actually, Simon, it's Mitch Stone. I apologize for getting here a little late. I had an emergency happen, and I just got home, was able to make the phone call.
Oh, Mitch. Let me introduce Mitch to our listeners. Mitch Stone is a defense attorney, although he's also played the other side of the fence as prosecutor. And his speciality is drugs.
True. Good afternoon, everybody. And, yeah, that's pretty much what we do. I think most criminal defense lawyers will have to claim at least a large portion of their practices related to defense of people accused of various drug offenses.
Okay, Mitch, I'm actually looking at... you know, one of the questions that I wrote for myself, and this seems a very good time to ask it. Does the time fit the crime?
In terms of what they have legislated for,
right,
drug offenses?
Yes.
I think it's they're taking a sledgehammer to a attack. I mean, the amount of time that people are doing for nonviolent drug offenses is just incredibly outrageous. I think most people would agree. Very unfortunate. There's people doing 10 and 20 years for very insignificant crimes. But these minimum mandatories and exceptionally difficult sentences that they are able to dish out for simple drug offenses is just it's too much. So no, I would say the time definitely does not fit the crime. You know, obviously, if you bring guns and violence into anything, then you're going to increase the sentence, and no one's going to argue that you are necessarily being treated harshly. But when it's nonviolent, when it's just usage or possession, or even minor sale, it just seems that they're... I'm defending somebody right now who's charged with selling cocaine, and the state's offered him his 10 years in prison because he had a prior offense.
Ouch.
I doubt that it will result in that, but he's facing, with all charges included, up to, you know, 30-plus years. So they think they're being reasonable, but the reality is it's just that's just too much.
We were talking earlier about the prospect of decriminalizing drugs, the way that Mexico has recently, you know, having small amounts is no big deal. You know, be the equivalent of walking around with a couple of baby aspirins in your pocket. You know, no one's going to bust you. Do you think we should adopt that same idea?
Well, the libertarian in me says yes. Obviously, I think that the reality is that no politicians will ever gain enough footing to agree to do that for fear that they wouldn't be reelected. So I just have a real tough time thinking that there would be enough of a groundswell to make that happen. Now, what I will say is that the medical marijuana and normal lobbies have succeeded in getting the medical marijuana use of marijuana legalized, and that's a good thing because I think that anybody would agree that if somebody is ill and you can provide them medication in the form of a marijuana cigarette, why would you and it would provide them relief, why would you not allow that person that relief?
I agree. Why deny that?
Oh, okay, Carlton, I have to bring you back into the conversation with that comment. We were talking earlier about California, and yes, it's you know, there are legal spots where you can pick up your marijuana, but you know, God forbid that the cops pull you over and find it.
Absolutely. I mean, you're going to get charged, you know, with an illegal substance. And it happens all the time. As a matter of fact, I believe there was somebody just recently here in Los Angeles who was charged with having just gone to a clinic and gotten some medical marijuana, or at least half a lid or something like that, had it in his car and got pulled over and got arrested and charged with illegal possession. So, the whole laws are very inconsistent. And it depends on who you are and where you are. If you can get it home to your private quarters and smoke it.
but don't they carry a card or something from their doctor or some kind of a letter?
My understanding is that if they have a prescription, they can have the marijuana. I represented a person who actually, he was on his way to bike week from California, and he was driving all the way over to Daytona, and he got pulled over in Baker County, and he had 2 ounces of marijuana on him, but he also had a prescription. Well, they arrested him and charged him with felony amounts, and they were really being hard-nosed with him, but at the end of the day, we were able to establish it because he had the prescription. Florida didn't honor it, but they at least understood that he wasn't dealing the marijuana, and they gave him a break. But my understanding is in California, if you have the prescription, you're okay.
Well, you might know better than me, Mitch. I only know this dichotomy between the federal law and the state law,
right,
which allows, and the feds have busted various clinics for dispensing medical marijuana.
That was under the past administration. Eric Holder, the new attorney general, has basically said that they're not going to authorize the federal authorities to enforce marijuana laws in California in the same manner that they enforce them everywhere else. Now, certainly, kilos of marijuana or bales of marijuana, whatever, being imported from Mexico or wherever, they're going to enforce that. But the dispensing of marijuana to patients, and they don't believe that there's any validity to that, but they said that they would at least honor that. I will say that I think that where we're probably heading is never legalized, but it'll be decriminalized in certain places where they'll be able to generate income by giving people tickets for having it, which would make sense, like a speeding ticket. They could generate a lot of money that way if they decriminalized it without giving it validity the way they're concerned about because of the gateway drug issue I heard someone talking about earlier.
Would they let them keep it?
No. I've had discussions with DEA agents and various people involved in the drug war from the government side, and they're very much opposed to it. For whatever reason, they have they've drank the Kool-Aid. They think that marijuana is just a terrible drug that is just killing our society, and they're really true believers in that. And I just see it from a different perspective and realize that is just not the case.
Even in California, you have rogue police officers that go around busting these dispensaries, despite the law.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think that even if you have the prescription, there's nothing that says that they have to agree that the prescription is valid. They can still arrest you. So I think Carlton may have been talking about something like that, but they're not supposed to. Now, whether they honor that, but then again, we see things happen in law enforcement all the time that they're not supposed to do something, but they do it.
Not only that, but like you were saying last week, they get arrested for a quarter of, say, a quarter of weed, and then they have to deal with bonding themselves out, and then court costs, and then lawyers and so forth, and it then becomes even more Absolutely.
As an aside, we do know that the marijuana growers are using the mountains here in California to grow their marijuana, and they're causing all kinds of forest fires. I'm right now looking out my window at the La Cañada Flint Ridge forest fire, which is burning like crazy, making the air deadly here in Southern California.
What, from the marijuana?
Well, I don't know whether this one's from the marijuana.
Go outside and take a couple of deep breaths.
Get high. Right?
That's a free party.
No, it's not like that. Go outside and take a couple of deep breaths and hurry inside and cough.
The population in California will increase now.
Trying to sell more burritos at the local taco stand.
They're already calling Oakland Oaksterdam.
We've talked about marijuana. Marijuana has a problem in that you got to grow the stuff. That takes space. You can certainly do it inside the hydroponics and high bright lights, but the electric bill tends to rocket. So, there are other drugs that are much easier to manufacture. Crack cocaine. It's cheap, it's cheerful. You can get most of the products from your local Walgreens that doesn't stock marijuana. It's dangerous. It's dangerous in the manufacturing process. It's even more dangerous in the using process. And it has become a very insidious drug. How do you stop that one?
What I say about crack, and Mitch, you can correct me if I'm wrong, from what I believe, it's the only drug which there's a federal mandatory minimum sentence for, just like a little bit?
Well, cocaine itself has minimum mandatory sentencing, and crack cocaine still does on the books, has a much more significant, it was 100-1 in terms of the amount to get you to the minimum mandatory, but it's a 10-year minimum mandatory for a relatively small amount of crack. What you needed 500 grams of powder for, you only needed 50 grams of crack for. They're correcting that now, believe it or not, and the government through the various government agencies via the U.S. Attorney's Office, Department of Justice, et cetera, has kind of weighed in on this and agreed that after 20 years of essentially locking away inner-city black kids for 10 years plus for what would take 100 times amount for somebody in a more affluent area who doesn't do crack, who has powder, to get the same amount of time. They've corrected that. And we were always fearful that they would correct it in the other direction and say, fine, we'll just make cocaine that. You only need, 50 grams of cocaine now. But what they did was they've kind of agreed at this point that they need to correct that down to 1-1 instead of 100-1. And there was a lot of discussion whether about a year ago they were talking about bringing it down to 80-1 or 50-1 or 20-1, and finally they came out and said 1-1. It should be what takes the same amount of crack, what takes the amount of cocaine that it takes to get you to a 10-year minimum mandatory, it should take the same amount of crack.
You're talking primarily possession. How about the cookers? The manufacturers.
In the federal area, you basically have a manufacturer distribution type counts as in addition to the possession. And usually the feds charge it as a conspiracy anyway, so you're looking at a possession and a distribution. But and a manufacturer. Cooking crack is pretty easy to do, from what I understand. You know, I just read that the new meth labs, that they've devised a new way of cooking up meth now, where it literally can be done by individuals in a soda bottle. I'm not sure exactly how the process, but apparently they can cook their own personal amounts just by putting some chemicals in a bottle.
Oh, my
much less
goodness.
Sudafed. Shaking it up.
I can somewhat testify about cookers and crack, because I used to go to my one dealer and watch him cook his crack over the kitchen stove in a large pot, you know, and cook it up just like he was cooking a soup or something or other, and then we'd cool it off and cut it up into little squares. You know, it looked like it was pretty easy to do, you know. I was always quite amazed that all it took was just a little kitchen area, you know, and that's all it took.
That's why they call them cookies, because it would come out from the bottom of a pan or a pot, and it would be round and look like a cookie.
Yeah.
That would be a specific amount. That would be cracked up into smaller pieces.
Yeah, just carve it up into little squares and wrap it in plastic, and there you'd have it. And he would have a lookout out on the street, you know, that would watch for him while he was cooking, and see who was coming, you know. It was all very quite sophisticated in terms of its surveillance and the way you had to approach his house here in South L.A.
Man. Mitch, you know, we've been talking mainly about street drugs, but you also work with other folks that are involved or, you know, have been drawn into the drug trade. Doctors. We were talking earlier, before you dialed in, you know, about doctor shopping and, you know, are doctors to blame for, you know, over-prescribing? What's your theory on that?
Well, funny you'd ask. I just signed up two more clients who are charged with, one is charged with working with a doctor to get false prescription out to the public. The allegations are that the person basically was kind of like the front for the doctor, and the doctor would give him the bogus prescriptions, and he would kind of deal them out to various people who would then go fill the prescription, and then they'd sell the pill on the street for $20 a piece or whatever they were getting. And so that's obviously a pretty major problem for the doctor and my client, if those allegations are in fact true. And then I've signed up another guy who is alleged to have falsified prescriptions and brought them to the pharmacy in order to get the pills. In both cases, the trafficking in hydrocodone has been alleged, and the person is looking at 15 years plus. So they're very aggressive on false prescriptions and prescription medication. It's all related to hydrocodone, oxycodone, and OxyContin. Seems to be a pretty concerted effort on the part of the government to try to lock down this trafficking and this what has basically been called a synthetic heroin.
Right. I mean, just how serious are the, you know, XXX codeine products?
From what I get, I mean, they're very beneficial from a medical standpoint. I mean, they're great painkillers for people who have back problems or people who undergo dental surgery or whatever. You know, they're prescribed regularly for patients of doctors who are experiencing pain. I know that when I had dental surgery, they gave me a prescription for Vicodin, and yeah, that worked. I mean, no question about it. But they were very sparing with how much they would prescribe, because all doctors are a little sensitive now.
Right. Queenie, let's bring you back into the game.
Yes.
What's your theory on what we've been talking about?
You mean about prescription drugs or?
Yeah. Or anything.
Well, I don't know. I just my experience has been with my son, like I said, and his meth. He got into meth and destroyed my house and went after me with an axe and but anyway, he eventually moved away from me clear across the country, and he's now living there in Maine. But it's hell. I mean, trying to get him help was hell. And we have a big meth problem here in the county I live in Washington State. But no mental health help at all here.
Actually, mental health is a great subject. There isn't any. You know, if you've got a broken arm, you can go to the local emergency room. They go, oh, you've got a broken arm. You know, we can fix that. But if you go to the same mental health clinic and say, hey, I'm not feeling so good, they say, oh, take an aspirin and have a nap.
Well, funding seems to be a big problem. Funding for mental health is a big problem.
Armando, what do you think about the mental health situation?
I agree with Carlton. I mean, it's definitely a big part of it. I mean, people that are manic depressive or whatnot, they tend to go to these drugs just to escape from reality, just so they're not in that state of being depressed or whatever, you know, their mind's leading them to. And it's definitely, I mean, I think rehabilitating the addict, you know, would do a lot for the war on drugs, the war on the addict.
Carlton, I've got to get you to weigh in.
Well, the it is said that the largest mental hospital in America is the Los Angeles County Jail. You know, and I know of many people who are in there for various crimes, who are basically mentally ill, very severely mentally ill. And what happens to the severely mentally ill is that they end up doing a crime, and only then do they get mental health help. You know, the families for these people have been crying out, trying to get help for their sons, their daughters, and finally the son or daughter does something horrendous like kill someone or stab someone, and then they end up in jail, then they get help, you know, and because they can't get any help beforehand. And it's because there's no funding for it. And I think we're going to see the same kind of problem happen here as this new health plan goes through the government. This is the first thing that's going to get axed, is mental health funding. And scares the hell out of me.
Yeah.
Oh, I think there's no doubt that mental health will be the first thing that goes away. You know, out of sight, out of mind. You know, it's the broken bone as opposed to the broken brain. Broken bone we can deal with. Broken brain,
And it's more acceptable, too, a broken bone compared to, you know.
Right.
The mental health is a bad, people don't talk about it.
Right.
Well, there's so much stigma associated with mental health issues, whereas there's not with you know, a cardiac problem or any of these others. I mean, there used to be with cancer, but that's gone away. And we really need to deal with the stigma surrounding mental health issues, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, schizoaffective, all of these kinds of things. We have to deal with that. And I've just been involved in the whole thing up here where a man opened a donut shop called Psycho Donuts. And Psycho Donuts, he had all these things called a bipolar donut, massive head trauma donut. and he had all these displays in here. I think he's now gotten rid of them, but he had a padded cell and a group therapy area, and then he had pictures on the walls of people in straitjackets and other stuff. I mean, it was all this stigma, you know, creating stuff about mental illness. And he couldn't understand why people weren't taking this, were upset about this, you know. Yeah, it was all a big joke, you know.
Reality.
You know, when you get television programs where someone, you know, is schizophrenic and, you know, the first thing that everybody worries about is whether or not they're going to axe murder you or something or other. And there's so many schizophrenics out there who, you know, so they hear voices. You know, they don't go out and kill people. You know?
Mitch, we were talking last week, and unfortunately there was a major meltdown with Blog Talk Radio. But about the time that the meltdown occurred, I was asking you what the percentage was, you know, street drugs versus prescription drugs. And I think you were saying that you're seeing a rise on the prescription drug usage.
Oh, absolutely. The majority of our cases coming in are now what I was talking about, the prescription drug-based cases. It's just incredible. What used to be just all cocaine cases, and then there was a bit of a shift to meth for a while, and then back to cocaine. I've had a handful of heroin cases, and, you know, you get these, and of course you get the marijuana cases pretty regularly, but most of the marijuana cases are smaller possession type stuff. I just handled a cultivation case where somebody had a grow house, but the vast majority of the cases now are coming out are these doctor shopping and prescription fraud cases, all dealing with hydrocodone-based drugs and a little bit of the a little bit of some other the anti-anxiety drugs as well, but mainly the hydrocodone. I've represented a doctor who was charged as being a principal in an internet pharmacy. You've seen these when you get spam in your email about get your, you know, medications here and these internet pharmacies. Well, they're supposed to have some kind of a component of medical review, and many don't. And if there's no medical review, meaning a doctor actually seeing the patient and prescribing the drug, these internet prescriptions are illegal, and they're cracking down on that. I've represented doctors who, as I indicated, were handing out bogus prescriptions. I represented patients who were getting, who were basically taking. I just handled a case where a lady took her prescription that her doctor gave her, scanned it into her computer, changed the dates, you know, every month, and would rerun the same prescription and with a different date, and submit it to the same to a pharmacy, and they would get it filled. So after 13 months of doing that, she finally got caught.
Wow.
But interestingly enough, I will credit at least the state attorney's office that I'm dealing with as being decent about how to handle these cases. In that case, for instance, I was able to establish that the woman had developed an addiction due to her dental surgery that she had gone through, and that she was basically, she was out of control, and therefore they're putting her case in diversion so that if she goes through a drug rehabilitation counseling and she's successful, they'll drop the charges. So that's good. But in other cases, you know, where to her, the reason why I got that result for her was because she was not dealing these drugs out on the street. She wasn't getting them to deal them. The state's concern, obviously, and they come down on the person much harder if they're getting an illegal prescription filled and then taking those pills and selling them on the street for street value to anybody, because obviously that becomes a little bit more, that's more in their view dealing and trafficking. But yeah, these prescription drug cases are, and interestingly enough, the users are of drugs, or I should say not users, because plenty of people are recreational users that don't have a real problem, but the people who are abusers who can't help themselves and who get out of control, they're gravitating more toward these legal drugs that you can get, that the possession of them is not necessarily illegal unless you don't have a prescription. You have a prescription, you can have as many as you, as that prescription allows for. So I tell people, if you have a bottle of this stuff and you're lawfully prescribed it, do not transfer your pills into a plastic baggie to go on a trip, because, you know, if you're stopped by law enforcement and they see hydrocodone-based drugs in a plastic baggie in your purse or in your pocket, they're going to assume it's illegal. If they see it in a prescription bottle with your name on it, you're going to be safe, but that's the only way. And the law enforcement are being trained to how to spot all the hydrocodone-based products. So whether it's Watson, whether it's Vicodin, whether it's Loratab, you know, they know the shape of the pill, the color of the pill, what's stamped on it, you know, how it appears. So they're being trained to be on the lookout for these drugs. So these cases are on the rise.
Ouch. I still come back to the question I asked earlier. You know, are the doctors to blame?
I don't think the doctors are to blame per se. I mean, American medicine has always been prescribed medication. That's what doctors are taught to do. If there's a problem, prescribe medication. Eastern medicine is less along those lines, and then you have a lot of homeopathic remedies, acupuncture, you have chiropractors, things like that do something other than just prescribe medication. But for instance, if you have a hurt back, American doctors are taught that, I should say Western, not American, but Western medicine, if you have a bad back and you have pain, they're not going to say, well, go to a chiropractor and get your back cracked, or go to an acupuncturist and see if they can get to the root of the problem, or you know, try drinking, you know, the root of a, you know, the root of a some tree. They're going to say, here, take this hydrocodone. It'll keep the pain from inhibiting your daily functioning. And every time you're experiencing pain, take another pill. And maybe one day your back will stop hurting you. Well, they're just treating the symptom, not the problem.
Simon, can I say something about doctors? Excuse me. Another thing that needs to be done is, like, if, say, for example, I'm prescribed hydrocodone from one doctor, I could go to another doctor, you know. I think they have to be linked together so that they know what's being prescribed to one person. You know what I'm saying? I know a friend who goes to two different doctors. They don't talk to each other. So how do they know the prescriptions? You know, they're not over-prescribing this person.
Actually, that's a very good question, and I was going to ask Mitch that very same thing.
Oh, okay.
You know, let's say I steal a prescription pad from a doctor, or I do what your client did, you know, which is basically scan it and change it. Are there checks and balances?
The quick answer is yes. There are no question about it. Our technology, computers, are becoming more linked, and so when one pharmacy receives a prescription, theoretically they can tie into a database that shows, you know, whether this is a prescription that should be filled or potentially is fraudulent. The problem is you have to balance the patient's privacy right, because we have the HIPAA laws that provide so much privacy for a patient, and rightfully so. I mean, rightfully so. As a patient, I don't want anyone knowing what my doctor prescribes me, what ails me, what procedures I may have had. That's my personal business. If I want to tell somebody, I'll tell them, but I don't want the government intruding on that information. I don't want anyone intruding on that information. It's on a need-to-know basis. Most people feel the same way. What's happening to them medically is their business and no one else's. So we have these HIPAA laws, which are very tight. So when you think about it, if you go to a doctor, the doctor prescribes you medication. You then go to a pharmacy to fill that prescription, and that pharmacy ties into another pharmacy that has filled a similar medication for you. That potentially is crossing the line of providing information that is not supposed to be provided. So they're trying to tweak the laws and tweak the ways that HIPAA works in conjunction with the criminal laws in order to allow for that information to at least red flag so that they know. But there is, doctor shopping is alive and well. People go to one doctor, they get a prescription, they go out of town to it, you know, they drive to the next town, go to another doctor, get the same prescription, you know, and they just fill them whenever they can. And there's, it's very hard to have perfect checks and balances. Now, where people ultimately get caught is when, for instance, somebody is trying to pass a fraudulent prescription. The pharmacist is being taught now to be much more diligent and vigilant and to actually communicate with that doctor's office to confirm that prescription was written for that person. So, you know, that's obviously one way of preventing that situation, at least from the standpoint of if someone steals a prescription pad. Now, interestingly enough, I've handled cases where the people in the doctor's office were waiting for the phone call because they're the ones that were taking the prescription pad and handing it to their friends and having so when the phone call came in, they would say, sure, that person is a patient and fill it. But you have all levels of people who are trying to manipulate the system.
I would suspect that if you're under some sort of insurance policy, that the likelihood would be less, you know, because insurance companies tend to keep a database of what's going on.
If you're getting your medication through insurance, obviously they have a way of, you know, they track everything. But again, I mean, I don't know that an insurance company would have the duty to put all points bulletin out for their own insured. For an insurance company to rat out their insured, that would certainly be bad for business. If I knew an insurance company would call the police if they suspected that I was getting a prescription that I shouldn't get, I don't know that I'd want that insurance company as my health care provider.
Yeah, right.
I mean, because it would be pretty easy for them to deny coverage by simply getting you arrested.
Yeah. It's very much a double-edged sword. You know, the one subject that we haven't talked about this afternoon are the designer drugs, ecstasy. Who wants to jump in on that one?
I'm pretty familiar with ecstasy. I've handled hundreds of ecstasy cases. That's just a standard party drug. And I know that when I was in college, it was legal. And I remember it started in Texas. I had some friends who went to schools in Texas, and they were reporting back to us that they'd go to this, you know, there was a bar or two that they could go to, and along with their drink, they could ask the guy behind the bar if he had any X, and, you know, they would sell it, and it was no problem at all. And then the state and federal authorities got wind of what this was. Most of the people who've done studies on ecstasy realize that it's not as there is actually some beneficial qualities to it, but the problem is that, you know, from a partying standpoint, I guess it can lead to some real problems, because the one or two times usage is not going to hurt you. It's the, you know, taking 5 ecstasy pills in a night and doing that on a pretty regular basis, that'll fry your brain cells, so it can be a pretty dangerous drug in that regard.
South Florida saw a lot of that in the mid-90s, from Orlando, Tampa, Miami. It was huge.
I guess I'm too old for ecstasy. I've never had it.
You know, what's interesting is that it started mainly in the kind of like the college communities, I'm finding most of the ecstasy cases I'm dealing with now are inner city. It's from the same groups that would have been dealing crack. That are, you know, they'll deal crack and they'll also deal ecstasy and weed. You know, you get your, you know, whatever you need from these guys. And those are the guys who I'm getting calls from who get arrested for ecstasy possession and sales.
Carlton, you were trying to say something. Jump in.
I was saying I think I'm too old for ecstasy. I never had any. Things that interested me were like magic mushrooms and LSD. So that's what I had when I was younger.
I think we likely are of the same age group.
Magic mushrooms were my favorite. I went out to the desert and did those.
but don't magic mushrooms, or peyotes, I think is the other name for them.
Yes.
Don't they make you throw up?
Didn't me. My friend and I went out into the desert and we had peyote. I can't remember how we. I think we chewed it. Yes, I do. I think we chewed it and ate it and drank it with some tea of some kind that we had. And then we watched the rocks move. And communicated with the eagles. It was all very, very spiritual.
Yeah, actually,
I've known several people that still.
I can tell you that having gone to school in Gainesville, picking up mushrooms out of cow pastures was a pastime. Probably still is. It's different than peyote. A peyote button obviously grows out in the desert. The mushrooms, the psilocybin mushrooms, grow out of cow patties. So it's
yum.
Yeah, I have represented somebody who went into a cow pasture and stole a bunch of cow patties. He followed the cows around and he gathered them up and he cleared a clearing out in the woods in his own area. He took the cow patties and he basically planted them and sure enough he was growing mushrooms. He had a little mushroom farm and then he would sell them at local concerts and he ended up getting arrested.
And Gainesville is party central.
Yeah. And what that is just an organic form of what you get in a tab of acid. Acid is a more concentrated form of psilocybin. So
I have a good friend that lives in Gainesville. He's a reporter. I'm going to ask him. I'm going to ask him about this.
Gainesville is capital central for parties, you know, with UF there and the Gators.
Yeah, I mean,
I've been there several times, and it's big there.
Now, there are occasions where he's just not reachable on his cell phone. I'll just bet he's out playing with those damn mushrooms.
Poor TJ.
Let's go back to street drugs. What needs to happen? How can we fix this problem? Do we need more cops? What do we need?
More education.
More education, says Armando. Explain. How would you do it?
I'd say more education in schools and, you know, teach younger kids more knowledge and rehabilitate the addict. You take away the addict, then the drug dealer just, you know, stands there. I say. I mean, that's easier said than done, but.
Carlton, your thoughts.
Well, I've sort of spoken my piece before. I think across the board legalization, you know, tax the hell out of all the drugs. Take it, you know, say to them, okay, raise it. You know, go ahead and raise cocaine and heroin in Afghanistan. Stop trying to stop it. And just tax the hell out of it, you know, and use that money for the health aspect of this drug. Try to make it unattractive in terms of what it is. Tax it, sell it at a very high cost, and use the profits from that tax to treat the addicts.
Okay, and Mitch.
Most sense, but I would say this: that is absolutely right on. I mean, if there were logic and reason going on in government, that would be the answer, because number one, you would take the billions of dollars that are being spent to try to prevent it and immediately have those billions of dollars to go somewhere else, and then you'd make billions of dollars on the sale of it, which would be such an incredible boon to our economy. We would probably it would be amazing. The problem is that the shift in the economy from all those law enforcement officers and people who depend upon the war on drugs, where would they go? What would they do? You'd almost have to, find something else with it that they could use their crime-fighting skills on. But I don't know. I would certainly say that legalization would be the answer if you wanted to try to stop the problem at the root of the problem, because I personally don't know anyone who wants to do drugs who can't. If they want to do them, they'll find them and they'll do them. And whether it's cocaine, marijuana, mushrooms, hydrocodone, whatever it is, they'll find it if that's what they want to do. If they don't want to do it, then they won't do it. So whether it's legal or not is not the reason why most people are not doing drugs. It's because it doesn't necessarily fit their lifestyle. But our government looks at it differently and thinks that the minute they legalize it, we'll have a, if you've ever seen the movie Reefer Madness, we'll have everyone doing crazy things on drugs because everyone will do drugs. And it's kind of like saying, that our citizens are really a bunch of children and that they have no self-control. The reality is that most people would probably stay with what they do now, which is either they do them or they don't do them. And if they do them, they'll be paying the higher price that Carlton referred to. In California, people who want to legally smoke marijuana go to a doctor that they know will prescribe it, and then go to a pharmacy, a marijuana pharmacy. Other people who don't bother with that still get weed in others from other sources. So, there's no sense that it would result in people who otherwise wouldn't do it doing it.
I think what I'm hearing here is essentially you're buying into the Mexican system. Small amounts, they're fine.
I think it would make the most sense. I think it would take a lot of the pressure off the criminal justice system, and those efforts can be directed to areas that really need the help.
Well, what does that say to the kids, I guess, that are, in school or whatever, and they're trying it for the first time, and now they know that it's legal for them to?
It's true. I mean, that's one argument is that how are we setting examples? But it's the same thing with alcohol. I mean, most kids who are in school, and my daughter just graduated high school and she's up in college, and she'll be the first to tell me that there was never a shortage of alcohol at any of the parties she went to, and there was never a shortage of drugs. If she wanted to drink, smoke, or do other drugs, she had the option of doing that at any given time. She just chose not to. So I don't think that it's the fact that it was illegal. It was the fact that it was just something that didn't necessarily fit her lifestyle, because she was an athlete and was more in tune to doing other things than getting wasted. But that's not to say that she didn't ever do it.
Well, my point on that was, when it, like, if it was illegal, then they would be more precautionary towards the risk than if it's not illegal and you don't have really much of a risk and you can go ahead and do it.
Well, that's true, too. I mean, think about it. There's no age limit from a drug dealer standpoint on who can buy the
drugs. Right. They'll
but
cater
it at a liquor store. You know, if you have a 12-year-old kid that walks into a liquor store, that liquor store ought not to sell him alcohol and probably wouldn't. But that 12-year-old going to a drug dealer, he doesn't have a problem with it, because who's he to judge?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, folks, I need to break in. We're about 50 seconds from going off air. I really want to thank our panel, Carlton Davis. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Mitch, always delightful to talk to you.
Thank you, Simon. I appreciate you having me on today.
And Armando, where's that next book?
It's in the works. I have five children, so my time is very limited.
This is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a great Saturday afternoon, and I'm sure we'll all be talking again soon. Goodbye.
So long.